Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
You may recognize the voice of my guest on this week's show from her role as the angsty tween girl Jessie on the Netflix animated series Big Mouth. But she is so much more than that.
Guys have said to me, you know, Jessie, part of what makes you so pretty is you have no idea how pretty you are. And then they're just like, enjoy. Is not nice. You know, that is like at best, that's like a backhanded compliment. And at worst, that's just like a forehanded insult, because I know that what that sentence really means is part of what makes you so pretty is that your self-esteem is so low, it's easier for me to f*** you.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and that was how Jessie Klein introduced herself to the world in her 2011 Comedy Central stand-up special. Jessie may not be the most famous comedian we've had on this podcast, but she is among the most influential comedy voices of the past two decades. After helping to develop shows like Strangers with Candy and Chappelle's Show as a behind-the-scenes executive at Comedy Central, Jessie went on to a prolific writing career of her own, including a one-year stint at Saturday Night Live before taking on the role of head writer for Inside Amy Schumer. Now, in addition to her incredible voice work on Big Mouth, which just got picked up for a seventh season, Jessie is the showrunner of I Love That For You, a new Showtime series co-created by and starring SNL's Vanessa Bayer. Here's a clip from the new show in which Bayer, who has just landed her dream job at a QVC-like home shopping network, runs into her childhood hero, played by fellow SNL alum Molly Shannon.
I'm Jackie.
I know who you are. I'm so fun to see your face and body and to meet you in the person.
Aw. And I wanted to say I didn't mean to act weird about training you. I'm just going through some junk. Oh, don't take it personally.
No, not at all. It's like insane that you'd be training me. I mean, you're like the best host in the history of SVN.
What? No, I'm not. Come on. What makes you say that?
Oh, so many reasons.
Really? Like what reasons? I want to hear.
You're like, you're so pretty. You're so smart. You know, you're Jackie. I've been watching you forever. I mean, kind of idolize you. Sorry. I can ask if someone else can train me. It's like insane that you would train me.
You know what? For you, I'm gonna do it. Oh. I got a lot of great pointers. And as you know, I'm really good at this. Welcome to the jungle, Joanne.
It's Joanna.
This was one of the most fun conversations I've had on the podcast in a while. So please stick around. Here is me with Jessie Klein. Thanks, Jessie, for doing this. I feel like there's a lot of stuff that I want to talk to you about, but I feel like I have to start with the fact that by telling you that I was a semi-regular at Punch Up Your Life, the show you did with Pete Holmes in New York years and years ago, because I lived right around there and really loved that show and saw so many incredible comics come through there at the Housing Works.
That's so fun. Housing Works is such a great place.
Yeah. I don't even remember if it was free or was it like, it was like $5 or something, but it was whatever it was what I could afford at that time. And it was
whatever
fantastic.
It was, I guarantee no profit was made. So yeah. I think it was fully free.
Yeah. But there were so many great comics. I remember seeing Zach Galifianakis for the first time there.
And
it was fun to see you and Pete Holmes hosting. And
oh my god,
I should tell you that.
I know, I love knowing that. Do you still wait, are you still in New York?
No, I used to live in New York and now I'm in LA.
Oh, you're in LA. Here we are in our LA homes.
But yeah, I thought we could kind of start by, you know, going back to those days and sort of where you were in your comedy life when you were doing that show.
Oh my gosh, I'm trying to remember. Really a tell at how old you are when you're like, fully blacked it out. Gosh, I guess that was probably around, I had lived in LA for a bit and moved back.
Oh, okay.
So I think this was like around 2009 or so, maybe.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah. And I think I also, trying to remember, I think like I was like in between having left LA and then I think maybe I was like in between starting at SNL for a season. Someone needs to fact check my life. This we'll all be lies. Yeah. I don't know. I'm trying to remember the timeline of it. But yeah, I remember I think I had just moved back to New York after being in LA for a little chunk.
And were you in LA when you worked? Because so one really interesting thing about your story, which people may or may not know, is that you actually worked at Comedy Central before you worked on, you know, Comedy Central.
Yes.
Behind the scenes. But you were working in development. Was that in LA that you were doing that? Or
no, that was in New York. Oh, that was like my first real job out of college after a couple of, I mean, the other jobs were also real. They weren't imaginary. But
it was kind of show business adjacent.
I graduated from college and I worked for a while at a video store that I had worked at, the dearly departed Allen's Alley in Chelsea.
Oh, nice.
It was really a great legendary video store. I worked there in the summers of college. And then I graduated from school, didn't know what I was going to do, knew I loved comedy. But this was also, again, old, pre kind of like real internet comedy, what exists now. So then went like video store to working at Bette Midler's clean up the gardens and public spaces of New York. Wow. Nonprofit as an office manager, where I realized I was really bad at managing an office. And then I started temping and I temped my way into Comedy Central and just happened to temp my way into the development department there. And this was like 1998, 1989.
Kind of a heyday of Comedy Central, right?
Well, it was like the beginning of a big heyday because it was right when South Park was like exploding and getting like truly at the time, like crazy numbers for, you know, a network that prior to that was like airing a lot of Benny Hill reruns. but also a ton of stand-up, which was like how I really, I mean, I loved watching all those stand-up specials. So yes, I ended up working as an assistant in the development department, and then stayed and rose through the ranks is such a weird word, but I was there for 7 years and it was kind of like going to comedy college. I learned so much and just was so lucky to work with like an incredible murderer's row of people.
What were some of the other shows that you actually worked closely on in that time?
I mean, the first ones I was like working on Strangers with Candy with Amy Sedaris and Stephen Colbert. You may have heard of them.
Yeah.
but who were not, you know.
Yeah. No one really knew who they were then. Yeah.
No, nobody did. Or very few people did. I worked on Upright Citizens Brigade, was becoming a sketch show. So, you know, Amy Poehler and Matt Besser and Matt Walsh. And Ian were all coming through the office as kind of unknowns. I worked while I was there on Chappelle's Show. I worked on David Attell's Insomniac. It was really great. It was just such an incredibly, just like such a stroke of luck, like very life-changing to end up there.
I saw on your IMDb that one of your earliest on-screen credits was on Chappelle's Show. Was that while you were working there?
Yes. Oh my God. I love that you checked IMDb. Always, always like the most accurate reflection of a person's career. Although I actually think mine is kind of accurate. Yeah. Dave Chappelle threw us into a sketch where we essentially played ourselves, myself and my boss.
I'm sorry. I can't do this anymore.
What? Why not?
I'm burnt out, Lou. I got a family, man. I'm working 20-hour days every day. I ain't making no money. Mr. Hanky makes more than me.
Dave, you signed a contract for 2 seasons, and I don't know if you've read USA Today, but we expect you back for a third.
Oh, really? Really expect me back, huh? Well, guess what? Expect this. My resignation, effective immediately. I quit!
Suit yourself, Dave. You've already shot all of your sketches. At this point in the season, you're replaceable.
Replace me? You gonna replace me? Dave Chappelle of Chappelle's Show. I like to see that.
That must have been a little strange.
I mean, part of why I didn't want to be a development executive anymore, and not, you know, and I think an amazing development executive is an amazing development executive, and there are bad ones and there are great ones. But I kind of felt at the time, like I always feel like when I'm like, I worked on Chappelle's Show, I don't want to overstate like my role.
You weren't writing, yeah.
No, you know, Dave is and Neil Brennan, they're both geniuses and they, you know, but it was just an amazing thing to kind of witness the process and occasionally chime in something that didn't really make it. Part of why I ultimately after 7 years was ready to leave is I knew I just wanted to be more a fully creative writer, performer, person. And
what were your big goals when you were, you know, deciding to leave? Was it stand-up? Was it writing? Because you've done, you know, a lot of both, but where were you sort of thinking you wanted to go?
I don't think I ever really imagined I was someone who would like really be committed to doing stand-up. Just because, I mean, I love doing stand-up and it was such a formative part of my creative experience, but the like full tilt in your molecules necessity to be like so in it on the road and out every night, that version of it, I didn't have in me. I don't think I was like truly, not to put myself down, I think I was fine. I don't think I was, I think I could, I mean, could have been a contender. I don't, you know, I just never committed to it as deeply as you needed to. And I loved doing it, but I think the writing path I felt like was, oh, I could kind of picture making a living at this. Although I don't want to overstate that either, because I remember seeing an interview with Larry David many years ago where he talked about even, you know, years and years and years into Seinfeld, he would still walk down the street in New York City and be like, I guess if I'm homeless, I could live in that box. That's a good vent. I would like live over there. And I'm very much still there.
Yeah, you feel that way too?
And yeah, 100%.
What you're saying kind of reminds me of what, you know, Judd Apatow has said to me on this podcast and elsewhere, where he was, you know, coming up as a stand-up and he was looking around and his friends were like Jim Carrey and Adam Sandler. And he was like, well, I'm not as good as them. So I don't know. And I think maybe he was just unlucky to have such a successful friend.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like Judd's not a funny enough guy, but yeah, I think I remember hearing Judd Apatow say that. Yeah. I mean, I do look around. It is. You kind of think about it. I do really remember, I think, hearing that interview. And now, I mean, I did feel like at the time when I was performing, I'm like, there's a lot of very, very funny people around me and people I'm doing shows with. And like those people were like Nick Kroll and Ali Wong. And I mean, too many other incredible people to name. I mean, Zach Galifianakis, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, it's like a generation of people where you just realize, oh, I was so... I can't believe I was like on the same shows as these people.
You did ultimately get a special on Comedy Central, though. That was pretty exciting.
I did. Yeah. I'm very happy that I kind of, it felt like, you know, I got like that opportunity to kind of put out like the stuff. I mean, I haven't seen it in years. I think I'd probably crawl right under the carpet if I were to watch it now. But it was like, I mean, yeah, I did love doing stand-up and like, I kind of would love to do it again one day. It just hasn't, I've been a little busy with other stuff.
Yeah. Was there a moment where you kind of veered in the writing direction and what was that first job that you got, in a writer's room?
Well, buckle up, Matt. It was, my very first real writing job was on the Showbiz Show with David Spade.
One of David Spade's many shows. I feel like he's had a lot of shows.
He's had a lot of shows. Yeah, I got this one and had, you know, it was really funny. I mean, David was really lovely to me and was really makes me laugh. And so it was like a good experience. I do remember we were working at some... So that's when I moved to LA for the first time. I just hung on to my New York City apartment, as everyone should always do until they can't possibly anymore. Yeah. But I went out to LA to do that. It was like a 3 or 4 month gig. And we were working on a lot where like right when we were starting up, this other like kid show was starting up. And like we would sort of be walking past the kid show office and we were all kind of like not making fun of it to be jerks. But we were like, what is this kid show? Like, no, oh, we're working on The Big Hit. What's this stupid, I don't know, some Disney show. And that show was just increasingly like huge crowds of like literally hundreds of people were coming. And that show was Hannah Montana with a little gal we now know as Miley Cyrus. And then our show, I think, lasted like 2.5 seasons or something. Oof,
yeah.
But it was a great, I mean, it was a first job.
Yeah. And did you learn a lot about what that takes to write on a, because that was sort of more of a late night style show or?
Yeah, it was a little bit of a combo. It was like a kind of late night talk variety, but like not nightly, once a week, which is way easier. But, you know, just any job like that, that you, your first job writing or I guess doing anything is always just like a holy shit. I learned a ton. I learned a ton. Sometimes what not to do, but other things what to do.
Did that lead to SNL somehow, or did that, or were there something in between, or?
Yeah, there were a few things in between. I went from that show to, I got like my first like scripted narrative job after this. Again, you'll have to check my IMDb.
Yeah, I'll go back to IMDb.
like really keeping track. It was a single camera sitcom, again, with a true murderer's row of people called Samantha Who, starring. Yeah. It was a little bit of a goof of a plot, but it had Christina Applegate and Jean Smart and Melissa McCarthy and Kevin Dunn. Like, and you know, Melissa McCarthy pre-Bridesmaids. Jean Smart, certainly much of a long career before, but has winning Emmy after Emmy again now, as she absolutely should. And Christina, the most brilliant ever. And it was a show where she played someone who got amnesia.
Yes. There's so much comedy there. I mean, so much to work with.
You know what? Anything that has those people in it. It was actually a very sweet, cute show. And I, again, learned a ton and met people I'm still friends with, which is kind of one of the most important things about, like, I feel like comedy writing jobs is you just, no matter what the job is, you like collect friends along the way that you'll have for the rest of your life.
And then with SNL, did you audition to be in the cast and get hired as a writer? Because that seems to be a lot of people, that's the path that they take, is they sort of end up becoming a writer almost inadvertently. But how did it happen for you?
Definitely not was not audition. No interest on either side.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly when I was 10, I grew up obsessed with SNL. Standard obsession. I left Samantha Who and then moved back to New York because I'm a New York City gal. Couldn't take it anymore. Well, not Samantha Who specifically, but just I really miss New York, and that's where I grew up, and my family's there. And like I said, held on to my apartment as if anybody gets anything out of this podcast, always hang on to your apartment in New York. Yeah. But and then I was back in New York, and gosh, I think I did a little bit of time on Michael and Michael Have Issues, with Mike Lane Black and Michael Showalter, who will probably come up again in this interview, that was a show where it was just two writers, and it was me and Kumail Nanjiani.
Wow.
In a little room with our desk pushed together.
That sounds fun.
It was insanely fun. Again, a young Kumail, just the best. Yeah. The best.
You kind of hit everyone before they blow up. Is that your specialty?
That's why I love to just like say I saw them first. And then I think after that I went to SNL.
I know you've talked a little bit about how it was maybe not the best fit for you or not the best experience.
Yeah.
But I'm curious what that was like, because it is such a dream job kind of thing, and it's something, you know, as you said, you grew up obsessed with, and then you're there.
Yeah.
And maybe it's not what you expected, or maybe you did expect it to be that. I don't know. But what was that like for you to sort of be faced with the reality of this thing?
Yeah. I mean, I was like a little older than some of the people that get hired to write. Like I'm trying to remember. I think I was in my mid 30s at that time. And I knew just enough already, because I'd now had a few friends who'd cycled through SNL, to know that it was very hard. And to kind of have like not just have my only idea about what it was like to be from just loving watching the show. And I had also had enough other jobs. I think it's just very much, there's really something, especially as a writer, to kind of having it be like your first or second job, because you don't have any other standard by which to measure like what's being asked of you in some ways. And again, none of this is to denigrate SNL, because I'm so honored I got to do it. I'm so glad I did it. But I really wasn't very good at it. I mean, I really kind of tanked it every week. I pretty much tanked it. I'm not emotionally cut out for it, or even physically. Like at this point in my life, I really am like such a, I can't stay up late, which was something I discovered.
Which you need to do there, apparently.
You really need to be able to stay up late. And I realized like, oh, I'm hitting a wall at about 10:15. And people write on writing nights, like write till 5 in the morning
all
there.
Night
so
long,
yeah, all night long. And it just isn't how I work well. Like I just don't, my brain, it just, I was really struggling there, but I don't want to make it seem like I'm making that my only excuse. Like if I just had more normal hours, it would be better. It just, yeah, I kind of started a little late too. Like I didn't get hired when the season began. Like they hired me a month or two in.
Kind of starting from behind, right?
It started a little from behind. You kind of really need to be able to like team up a bit with other newbies. And I now in hindsight with other things behind me know that I really love writing in like a real like collective environment with people. Like I later like working on Inside Amy Schumer, like, and running that room, I was just so into this idea that like everyone can just bring the most half-baked, quarter-baked idea to the table and we'll just kind of all do it together to find the idea.
As opposed to a competition.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, but again, there's just so many brilliant people who get there and thrive in that environment, even if it's hard or even if they don't like it. It just wasn't, I couldn't quite get a rhythm of it. And I think I, at the end of the season, if there's like a pass fail grade, I think I was a pass. Or so I like to tell myself. And if anyone, Seth Meyers or anybody's listening and knows that I was a fail, don't tell me.
You don't want to know.
I don't want to know.
Was there any, you know, sketch that you got on the show that you were particularly proud of?
I think I got honestly like truly one or two sketches on. I mean, in terms of things that I think I got several things went to dress rehearsal, you know, which then you get cut. You see if it goes well in front of the live audience. My big hit was when Tina Fey hosted, I wrote this little commercial parody called Brownie Husband. And that...
I remember that one. That was great.
That was a success.
You've had a long day. It's not easy being the perfect boss, the perfect best friend, the perfect aunt. But when you're done, who's there for you? Duncan Hines, that's who. With our newest indulgence specifically designed for the single woman. Introducing Brownie Husband, our very first companion dessert. In just 90 seconds, Brownie Husband bakes into a delicious partner just for you. A luxurious temptation that's only 120 calories per serving. Made of sumptuous Belgian fudge, Brownie Husband can satisfy all your cravings. The ones in your mouth.
You taste so good.
And your soul.
And I'm like, you know what? I'm glad I did my time on SNL, and I'm glad I got Brownie Husband. Like, you know, you have these things.
In a lot of ways, that feels like a sketch that could have lived on Inside Amy Schumer.
Well, I think that's why, yeah, I found my little space with Tina.
Did you have a very different experience on that show in terms of, you know, you said it was more collaborative, or it felt more for you in a way?
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't want to say SNL. I don't want to judge SNL at all, because the people who are on it are collaborating very well together.
But just for you.
For me, yeah. I think it was like, you know, Amy and I met doing stand-up. And when she wanted to do the show or had gotten this pilot opportunity from Comedy Central, like reached out to me and we sat together and had some drinks. And we just like the things we wanted that we talked about in our stand-up, even though stylistically we're a little different. And I certainly, I mean, Amy's such an incredible stand-up. So I'm not putting myself on a level with her, but our topics kind of aligned in terms of sort of talking about like the female experience. And so there was just a really nice like Venn diagram between us of what we wanted to talk about. And then we hired a pretty small room and yeah, getting to kind of run it along with Amy and our other delightful work husband, Dan Powell, who was the other EP and showrunner on it. It was just so fun to do. It just, and it always just felt like, you know, the things that were like weird and funny to me were like really in the strike zone of the show. And so we would just sort of get to do them all.
Coming up, Jesse shares the story behind one of the most iconic sketches she ever wrote for Inside Amy Schumer.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of The Last Laugh is brought to you by Vanderpump Villa, a new reality show starring Lisa Vanderpump, now streaming only on Hulu. Join Lisa and her hand-selected staff at Chateau Rosabelle, a glamorous estate in the French countryside. Meet the elite staff as they work, live, and play together 24/7 while dealing with rivalry, romance, and misadventures. As they try to provide once-in-a-lifetime experiences for their guests, the staff will need to meet Lisa's high standards. Not everybody has what it takes. Watch new episodes of Vanderpump Villa every Monday, now on Hulu. If you're enjoying this episode and want to hear more, please make sure you are following The Last Laugh wherever you get your podcasts. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to my conversations with some of Jesse Klein's Big Mouth co-stars like Nick Kroll, Jason Manzoukas, Pamela Adlon, and more, along with everything else from our free archive. And you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Tuesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to Jesse Klein. It's funny you mentioned, you know, writing for Tina Fey as host of SNL, because, you know, the sketch that I always think about is the Last Fuckable Day sketch, which is just seemed like such an achievement at the time. Yeah. And now to get those actresses together with Amy for that sketch. And I know you were instrumental in that as well. So can you talk about the idea behind that and how you pulled it
off? I think I had that idea the first or second season. And it just the casting of it just seemed like kind of impossible in some way. I think we were also, and I think that, so that came out of, I was still like really a pretty committed Us Weekly reader at the time. Yeah. Like I really loved reading my like shitty little rags. And yeah, just like being very obsessed with pop culture world and just like kind of getting obsessed with the idea, like what is the moment that like women, it's like they're hot, they're hot, they're hot. And then like, where is there like a graspable second where they tip, like a tipping point? And we talked about it in the room and it made people laugh. And I think our casting, I think originally we were kind of trying to cast it with older actresses who were more like in their, you know, 60s or 70s.
Yeah. Were there other people that you were thinking of or going out to? Or
I truly can't remember anymore. But then we realized, and then we just, I think it was season three or whatever, took another swing at it and realized it might be better if we, like find women who are kind of more like living that kind of moment.
It's actually funnier if they're a little younger.
If they're a little younger and kind of like, you know, feeling that, you know, obviously the older actresses we want to cast are all very beautiful, but just, you know, in terms of like, is this feeling very like alive to you right now? Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, I think the way it happened was Nicole Halfcenter, did some stuff with the show and she was able to, we wanted her to direct it. And she was, I think this was how it happened. And then she was able to kind of get it to Julia, yeah. To Julia Louis-Dreyfus. And then after that fell into place, I think we got the others.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was like a real achievement just in terms of like that day. I mean, it spanned the creating of a life because originally thought of it, I believe I was single. And by the time we shot it, I was like 6 months pregnant.
Oh, wow.
Is it someone's birthday or?
Oh. Kind of the opposite. We're celebrating Julia's last fuckable day.
Yes.
Salute.
Sorry, did you say Julia's last fuckable day? Mm-hmm. What is that? Mm.
In every actress's life, the media decides when you finally reach the point where you're not believably fuckable anymore.
I mean, how do you know? Who tells you?
Well, nobody really overtly tells you, but there are signs. How Sally Field was Tom Hanks's love interest in Punchline, and then like 20 minutes later, she was his mom in Forrest Gump.
Or you might get offered a rom-com with Jack Nicholson where you're competing with another woman to fuck him. Or I just had an audition for Mrs. Claus.
You're kidding me.
I read for that part.
I read for that too.
You did?
Hey, who got that?
J-Lo. Oh, she'll be good.
She's going to be really good.
Really good.
And was like, you know, we flew to LA to do it. And I remember we also were just so used to like the way we shot that show was just so down and dirty, like early days of Comedy Central. Like we were always on location. It was always January, February in New York. I remember like sitting fully like in a bathroom, like on a keg in a bar, like just that was so small. And like just being like, what are we? We were just always under such kind of intense like conditions for TV. And then when we went to LA to shoot this sketch, because we had these like A-listers involved, I remember like me and Amy texting, like, I think she got there first and she was like, look, trailers. And then we have like really great craft service. There was like a burrito station and we were just like, what?
You pulled out all the stops for the, for the actresses. Yeah.
Yeah. And like Tina Fey is here and it was, Patricia Arquette, it was crazy.
Yeah, it's so good. I could imagine. I was wondering if they took much convincing to get, but maybe once you get Julia on board, then the other ones agreed. Or
yeah, all the puzzle pieces. Nicole was really instrumental in it too. But yeah, it was just such a
absolute classic of a sketch. So
I'm glad.
Congrats.
Thanks.
I know. So the show ended at a certain point, and then there was like no one knew whether it was coming back for a long time. And now it seems like there are going to be new specials, not really a new season, but something on Paramount Plus. Do you know anything about this?
Yes. I'm very excited to see how it turns out. I was just I don't want to misspeak about it. I think it's 5 episodes, and it was kind of the current deal with Comedy Central that Amy has, and I just desperately wish I could have worked on it, but I was working on I Love That For You with Vanessa, so it just didn't quite time out. But I can't wait to see it.
Yeah.
I love Amy.
Kind of weird for you to just see it as a viewer, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's some fun in that too sometimes, where you kind of get to see like how things evolve.
Yeah. So I want to get to I Love That For You, but I do want to touch on Big Mouth first, which is just one of my favorites. And I've talked to so many people from the show on this podcast, including Nick. And so you are not a writer on that show, right? You're a voice actor.
No, I'm just a little show pony who comes in and does my little character that they made almost exactly like who I really am, so that I don't really have to act.
Yeah. Was that part written for you? I mean, it has your name, obviously. And as you said, she has a lot in common with you. So.
I don't think, no, she's based on someone that Nick and Andrew went to junior high or high school with. But I think when they were casting, I think just because Nick and I are old pals and we used to do another live show together, luckily for me, thought of me and felt like this was within my performing reach. Yeah. And so that's how I ended up getting to do Jesse Glazer.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting with some of these longer running animated shows. You know, I've talked to people from BoJack Horseman or Bob's Burgers. It's like, and this show, you end up playing the same character over many years in a way that you don't, you know, when you're doing other shows or sketch or something.
Yeah.
You get to really kind of get to know this person, even if they are, you know, an animated character. So what has that been like for you to really, you know, get to play this same character for so long now?
I mean, it's truly the most fun freaking thing in the world because, I mean, getting to just do, first of all, just animated voice work. What a sweatpant covered blessing that is.
Yeah. Seems like this might be the best job in show business.
To just eat what you want and you roll in and disheveled as I like to do. And, you know, you're in another. I mean, but aside from that, I mean, the show, what Nick and Andrew and Mark and Jen and all the rest of the writer's room have done with that show is just so gorgeously brilliant and funny. And, that is another like look left, look right. Like who is around me? Like kind of pretty sure I'm the weak link there, but just the level of talent that's doing it. There was like a moment, I can't remember which season is which because, you know, it's like it takes so long and we're recording ones that are so far in the future from what's on. But I mean, the people just in general, the cast, the regular cast, the Mantzoukas and just, I mean, you know, Mulaney and everyone is so brilliant. And then there was a day where I was in there recording with like Sterling K. Brown. It was like playing
Jesse's boyfriend.
And I have such a crush, physical talent, all of it, like just obsessed. And I was like, when they first told me like, oh yeah, we're thinking that's going to be Sterling K. Brown. I was like, are you fucking with me? And that was just, I mean, he's everything aside from my physical whatever's, I mean, just one of the greatest actors we have. And then I'm like, I have taken about 6 acting classes and I don't mean 6 courses.
I mean individual
like a learning annex situation. And I was just like, oh. And I mean, he's just a dreamboat of a lovely man. But yeah, the things I've gotten to do are just, I mean, Pamela Adlon, that is really of all, aside from the millions of lives lost in the pandemic, one of the saddest things to me is like that there are scenes with me and Pamela Adlon, who's truly one of my full heroes, that we didn't get to record together.
Yeah, everything was kind of isolated during the
everything
pandemic.
Was kind of isolated. But oh, and then, but I mean, then also the moments with like Maya Rudolph talking.
Oh, yeah. I was going to ask about that. Your scenes with her, you know, are incredible.
What are you?
I am the hormone monstrous.
If you're here to tell me how terrible being a woman is, the Statue of Liberty and my mom already covered that.
The French are full of shit and your mother's a woman in decline. You're on the rise, girl.
I am.
But you'll have to make some changes, Dumplin'. For instance, what the fuck is this?
It's my baseball mitt.
Get rid!
Hey!
Listen to me! You want to shoplift lipstick? You want to listen to Lana Del Rey on repeat while you cut up all your t-shirts? You want to scream at your mother and then laugh at her tears?
But I don't want to scream at my mom.
She's not your mom anymore. From now on, you call her Shannon.
You're very beautiful.
I know.
Why do you smell so good?
Because I don't use deodorant and I only take bubble baths.
I've been lucky enough to like do a lot with Maya where we were together, together in the studio. And I'm just kind of always awestruck and really struggling to be in the moment because, I mean, is there a more perfect unicorn in this world than Maya Rudolph? Probably not.
Yeah, and playing that character of the hormone monstrous, it seems like it was just made for her, and she's so fabulous.
She's so fabulous, but I mean, to kind of get back to your, I mean, for me, just getting to go plug into like the puberty feelings and like get to kind of try and tap back into like the teenagerishness of it all, or the tweenagerishness. I'm really stroking out. That is so fun to do, and also feels very, it's like a real release for me, because I think I still really feel so many of those same feelings now, like as a mother and a 40 something person. I'm 46. So I really still feel like there's like a second puberty I've been in of like becoming this other thing, you know, yeah. And getting to like, it feels like Jesse ends up screaming a lot.
You get to, that's kind of like cathartic.
A lot of primal screaming that happened. And that is, yeah, it's truly, it's a cliche to say, but it's like such a gift.
Do you think about if and when you might show Big Mouth to your kid?
You know, it's so funny. Someone was just asking me about that. And I hadn't even, I have friends who have told me they watch it with their tween kids. And on the one hand, I'm like very, it's so satisfying to hear, because it's such a, it is, yeah, such a beautiful,
so
show.
So valuable to that and, age to see it in a lot of ways.
Yeah. So many like, necessary hard conversations could kind of be bridged by watching it together. And yet, like, I could not watch that with my parents then or now.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Like I don't know. I'll have to cross the bridge when I come to it. I would love for him to watch it on his own when he's old enough. And if he wants me to watch, I will. But I mean, just so much cum.
Yeah.
So insane. Much masturbation. So much, I think, Jesse Glazer masturbating.
Yeah, it's a lot to see your mom.
To have separate rooms.
So let's talk about I Love That For You, which I got to see the first couple of episodes and really, really enjoyed it. It's so good. And Vanessa Bayer, unbelievable. And it's so great to see her have a vehicle like this.
I know. This has been such a truly special experience, just because the people involved are just so brilliant. And yeah. I mean, I remember, like, I truly remember the first time I saw Vanessa on SNL. I did not know her personally, yeah. But I think she started like right after I left.
I was going to ask if you overlapped, but
no,
I guess not. Yeah.
I think she may have started the year or maybe the second year after I left. Anyway, I was like, this is one of the funniest people I've ever seen. Like, everything about her style of humor, her vibe as a performer,
Do you remember what it was, the sketch or the bit that got you? Oh, this is another, yeah.
No, I mean,
rack your memory.
No. I mean, I know there was one specifically. I don't know if it was like the first thing I ever saw her in, but she does. I do remember this is like one of those ones where, like, you know, you have like a sketch that you just show to people over and over whenever you have like a moment of like, let's look at videos. She does this character that's like child actor that like destroyed me so completely. And anytime I watch it over, I am destroyed anew, where she just plays like what a child actor sounds like.
That one and the Bar Mitzvah Boy got me.
Yeah. Yeah. But just even like, it was just, she's just one of those people where like, she's so just inherently kind of like askew, mm-hmm. like yes. in the best way. And also has this real, like, just leads with this like sweetness mm-hmm. and kindness, which I'm very into, you know, it's like never in any way mean-spirited and kind of the opposite. But then there is also like a little...
Something a little off.
Something a little off. I remember also loving the thing that she would do on Update, I believe, with Fred, where they would play like friends who were kind of trying to like not talk shit about someone. And then they'd be like, doesn't she do the thing? Like that also That's I thought was like yeah. so real and so funny. Anyway, so yeah, just so... lucky to be working with her.
So how did you two connect for this?
Well, so I met her around. And then when my first book was coming out, we got paired, like I was doing some little event for Refinery 29, and I needed to do it with like a Q&A person. And I think I was like, how about would Vanessa do it? And so we met doing this little thing, and just, it was so fun to sit and talk to her. And we like went out to dinner afterwards. And so kind of made a connection with her there, and then tried not to dork out too hard. And then the other co-creator of the show, Jeremy Byler, is someone who I had worked on, Inside Amy Schumer with, and was one of our writers who just always thought was just so brilliant and so funny. And he and Vanessa created this, and pretty early on they needed a showrunner partner to kind of develop it with. And I was like, well, I think both of these people are full geniuses and delights, and what more could I ask for in terms of something to dive into?
Yeah. I mean, I think the show does an incredible job of channeling that very specific kind of awkward energy that she's able to do.
Well, I hail from Cleveland, the birthplace of rock and roll. And if you're looking for, you know, a really good friend who also is very professional, honestly, and loves her job, you know, she's a working girl and or whatever, then you should just call me up, because I love working, and I love to party within reason. And so, yeah, you know who to call for the friend and coworker of a lifetime. Yeah.
You set up this very big challenge for the show and her character in the fact that she's pretending to have cancer again, which is not the, you know, the most sympathetic thing to do. But then, you know, we really do, I feel like, you know, empathize with her character. So was that something that you talked a lot about, and sort of how to make her a, you know, sympathetic protagonist while also pretending to have cancer?
You know, I mean, we certainly did. I think in a sort of deeper way, like what I remember spending, I mean, again, it's been like a lot of years of development, so we've really talked about every aspect of it. But what I remember really trying to get, I was like, what is this lie really about? You know, like in this story, like what are we really saying about, like, why, what is the need? Like, what is the thing that is making her tell the lie? I think was kind of, for me, like one of the biggest concerns versus like making her likable.
Yeah, the whole likable thing has a lot of baggage too, right?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of can't wait for the day that like likability is not something we really need to like get into pretzels over, especially talking about female protagonists. Because have you ever heard of a little show called The Sopranos?
Yeah, well, right. I mean, that's the whole thing, is that men on TV are allowed to be monsters and women have to be likable, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just, we sort of instinctively know, I mean, you know, it's like Breaking Bad, The Sopranos, even like Larry David and Curb Your Enthusiasm. We're just going to like them because we're going to enjoy this show. And these are amazing performers. And Vanessa is kind of likable no matter what she does. I mean,
that was my experience of it. Watching
She's just, it's part of like why it's so amazing she has a show, because she's just such an incredible performer. But I think like the complications of her behavior, I think in some ways what we talked about more was sometimes like allowing her to be a little bit, not allowing her to be more unlikable, but in some ways to kind of push her behavior in more unlikable directions at times, because that's what makes it interesting. And I think Vanessa is so inherently sweet and funny and nice that we allowed ourselves, like, there were a few moments where we're like, well, we kind of should actually have her do something where her ambition is like a little more naked here, or seeing her make the quote unquote not moral, you know, or the selfish choice is actually would help us here.
Yeah. It's funny. It's like thinking about her in relation to, it doesn't feel like she's close to Larry David at all, in the sense that she's trying to be liked.
Yeah.
Basically the whole time, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that is, I think, the thing. And it's, I think, like, you know, Vanessa is such a sort of peace-loving, sweet human who it just, like, her essence, I think, has this nice balance of, she's so truly, like, just one of the kindest, sweetest people I've ever met. And yet, it's not a but, I think sometimes it's disarming, like, that she is ambitious in a good way. Like, I think sometimes she is very, very driven and very determined in a way that you might not kind of fully get at first glance, just because she's just so kind of casual and sweet.
Yeah, or she could be underestimated.
She can be underestimated, which was a lot of what we talked about kind of with her real life and this character. You know, she talked a lot of when we were going kind of just building it all about like that was one of her things in recovering from cancer as a young person, was like not wanting to be underestimated, you know, and people kind of being willing. It was what was fun and interesting about it, because on the one hand, being given a pass and like having people take it easy on her and not making her do things is so delightful for her. I think that's part of what's fun about the show, is like we all kind of would love to take the easy way out of things. Like, who doesn't relate to trying to do less and getting more? And at the same time, there is a part of her that doesn't want to be underestimated.
Yeah. Yeah. Before we get to our final segment here, I know you have a new book, and I really loved the excerpt that you just had in the New Yorker as well.
Oh, thanks.
Is there anything that you just want to tell people about the new book?
Sure. Yeah. The new book, it's funny because it's the book, the fact that the book and the show are coming out within like 2 days of each other, yeah, is such
a
COVID driven, kind of random accident of life. And it makes it seem like I'm way more prolific than I am. but yeah, I've been working on both of these for years and years. But the book is called I'll Show Myself Out, Essays on Midlife and Motherhood. And, yeah, it's kind of a collection of humorous essays, like the first book was, but just dealing more with the experience of, you know, being a mom, becoming a mom in my 40s, and kind of always feeling like, you know, in the world of being underestimated, just that tying it back to that, like that motherhood, I feel like in our culture is always kind of seen as like a who cares? Like, we kind of pretend to care, but then like no one wants to hear about the details.
Yeah.
And no one takes it seriously, even though it's incredibly hard. And so I just wrote this collection of essays that kind of talks about motherhood as like a hero's journey. And can we talk about this like it's something that really is worthy of being a story that is worth listening to?
Yeah. Awesome. So our final segment on the show is called The First Laugh. So I'm going to run through some firsts in your career and life around comedy, and hopefully we can get some quick answers before we go.
Okay. I'll try and be very, very quick.
Doesn't have to be that quick, but you know.
Okay. I'll try and be quicker than I've been.
So starting all the way back, do you remember the first piece of comedy or one of the first that really made you laugh as a kid?
The Marx Brothers, Groucho Marx. I know that Judd and I share this in common.
Yes.
Yeah, I was very obsessed with the Marx Brothers, watched all of those movies, read all of their autobiographies.
Oh, wow. Yeah. You went deep.
I went deep. Did a book. Yeah. Groucho's Harpo is still love them. Obsessed.
Do you remember the first time that you knew you were funny, that you could make other people laugh?
I think I wrote about this in the first book. There was a specific moment. I was a very sort of nerdy, friendless child in high school. Well, I mean, I had made some friends, but I could not make a friend in the high school I was in. But, and there were these cool girls. I was in a painting class, and the cool girls like never really talked to me. And even though we were painting next to each other for 2 hours a week. Anyway, and then one day one of the cool girls like kind of deigned to talk to me for a while. I'm making them sound like they were jerks. They were probably so nice.
Yeah.
And one of the, I remember she turned to me, she's like, you know, you're funny. And I was like,
I am.
Dina thought I was funny. Well, then I guess I am.
Do you know why she thought you were funny?
Because I was killing, Matt. I was killing in the painting club. No, I mean, it was my only tool. I was a little ugly duckling of a gal, and I had braces, glasses situation, and that was what I was leaning on when I was called upon to talk. She listened long enough to approve of my jokes.
When did you first perform stand-up, and how did it go?
I first performed stand-up when I was 26, which is pretty old.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
It's like hearing about someone being like a gymnast and not starting till they're 13, which is right when they should be peaking. But I did an open mic at a now defunct place in New York called Surf Reality that was run by a woman who wore elf ears. And you had to pay to perform. So it was set up for success.
So you have to really want it, yeah.
And you really have to want it. And I did well. I did well enough to continue. I think if I hadn't done well that first time, I probably would have bagged it.
Yeah. I think that that's what many, many stand-up comedians share is a successful first time out.
Success. Oh, yeah. And a full tank times two and three.
Yep. Do you have a story or a memory from your career that makes you laugh now, but really was not funny when it happened?
Oh, man. I feel like that's like most of it.
It's everything.
Oh, gosh. There are so many moments. I feel like, you know, I'm trying to think of a good one. I feel like I did a show early on. You just got offered such insane things to do. Mm-hmm. And you just sort of say yes to all of them. And this Orthodox Jewish couple reached out to me that they did these like salons, you know, in their apartment. And that they had like lots of people come. And I should come do stand up. Like they, and anyway, I was like, okay. And they were going to pay me like, $100, and I usually perform for free. So I was like, okay.
All right, yeah.
And then I got there and it just was a real light showing. Mm-hmm. And so it was like me, them, and like four of their friends in this apartment. And I, despite it being, I'm allowed to say, I mean, I'm also Jewish and I, but I'm not Orthodox. I walked in and I went to shake the husband's hand. Yeah, and you're not supposed to do that. I just schwitzed for an hour and left. And I was like, oh my God. Yeah, not supposed to take the Lord's name in vain either.
Yeah, but you had $100, so that was pretty good.
I had $100.
Do you have a story or memory about the first time you met one of your comedy heroes?
A good story.
It doesn't have to be a good story, but just something that just you remember.
Just meeting. About. I mean, there's been a lot of moments of like, you know, first time I met Tina Fey, I was like, oh my God, it's Tina Fey. Being in the studio with Maya, oh my God, Maya. Can I tell a story about Molly Shannon?
Oh, please. Because yeah, we should have mentioned her by now. But
yeah,
we
well, yeah. Just because also she has a book out now and also she's obviously, and I love that for you, and she's so brilliant. And it's just like a story I kind of want the world to hear, which is that.
Please, yeah.
So my year in SNL, I was there for the show that Betty White did. May her memory be a blessing. For Mother's Day.
That was
Day.
A big one, yeah.
It was a big one. And it was the Mother's Day show. And so like a lot of the like classic SNL ladies came back and they had Maya and Molly and Tina. And anyway, it was like a big thing. And I brought my mom to the show because my mom is like a big SNL comedy fan. And you know, I love my mom. My mom's very much a mom. So, but she was so excited and she loves Molly Shannon. And then I asked my mom, I was like, do you want to come to the after party? She probably doesn't because my mom's, you know, quite old. Yeah. But she was like, oh,
it's
yeah.
It's
quite late. I mean, the show's till one. I'm like, this is like an out till three situation. She's like, oh, yes, I would love to go.
Yeah. Can't say no to that.
Can't say no to that. This will be worth the time. We'll cut other things out, I said to make time. Anyway, I take my mom to the after party at this restaurant. And I'm like, mom, just know that you... Like, don't bother people.
Yeah. Because like,
be cool.
There's celebrities everywhere at these parties.
Yeah, just
be cool. Yeah.
Just be cool. And I was like, yeah, of course I'll be cool. So then we're there and Molly Shannon is, and I'd had like a lovely week. I got to meet Molly Shannon. She's just such a sweetheart, you know? Mm-hmm. And then Molly Shannon's walking by my table with my mom and she's just walking in. She's just done a show. She's like, hasn't had a drink or a sip of water. And my mom like grabs Molly Shannon. And I was like, mom. And she was like, can I get a picture? And Molly Shannon was like, oh my God, absolutely. She's like, do you mind if I just go put my bag down, just get a drink? And she's like, totally. I was like, mom, I was so mad. Yeah. And then Molly gets swept up. And then at some point I was like, mom, you got to go home. It was just so late. And we just didn't get a chance. Cut to a year later, I'm in San Francisco. And I'm doing this live reading of Wet Hot American Summer at some festival. And Molly Shannon is there. And I haven't spoken or seen Molly Shannon in that at least a year. Yeah. And then I get into a room with her. And again, we didn't know each other. We just had interacted a few times that week on SNL. First, I see Molly. She comes up to me. She grabs my arm. She goes, Jesse, I never got that photo for your mom. Oh my She's God. Like, I feel so bad. She's like, we've got to get, like, she just remembered it.
Yeah,
and she
that's
felt,
incredible.
She was like, I just lost track of you guys and she seemed so sweet. And I was like, you are the, and then to get to work with her on the show where her performance is just so incredible. And I just think of that with her all the time, that that's who she is.
Finally, I like to give comedians a chance to shout out other comedy, other comedians that are making them laugh right now. So do you have anyone that you want to shout out or shows, or I know it's a lot of pressure, but anything that, that you could think of that has made you laugh recently?
Sure. I mean, I'll just reel off the quickies. I mean, Amy Schumer's new show, Life and Beth, is so great.
So good.
Bridget Everett's show, Somebody Somewhere, is so great. And Pamela Adlon is in the last season of Better Things, which is just
the best.
It has, like, it honestly got me through the pandemic. I watched the entire series. It makes me cry. It makes me laugh. I love it so much. And I mean, a million others.
Yeah. But those are three great, great recommendations.
Yeah. Love them all.
Jesse, thank you so much. This was so much fun to get to meet you and talk to you. And I've just been following you from way back in the to the Punch Up Your Life days.
I love that. Thank you so much. I'm so glad you told me that. Thank you for having me. This was so fun.
Yeah, thank you. All right, cool. All right. I want to thank Jesse Klein so much for taking the time to talk with me for this episode. I Love That For You is currently available on Showtime's streaming platform, with new episodes airing Sunday nights at 8:30 p.m. on Showtime. And Jesse's new book, I'll Show Myself Out, Essays on Midlife and Motherhood, is also out now, and we'll put a link to buy it in the description for this episode. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes and see who is coming up next week on the show. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.